Welcome to In the Middle with Mark and Miles.
Hello, world, and welcome to another episode of In the Middle with Mark and Miles.
Machete. Machete.
I'm your host, Miles, with my co-host, Mark.
Yay.
How are you holding up, Mark?
Oh, I'm awesome. I am just awesome.
How many days have you been since you've been on lockdown?
I haven't left my apartment in exactly 9 days.
Oh, man. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
How did it feel?
Well, I don't think I can explain it to a general audience because I don't think it'd be PG rated.
Oh, man, that sounds like pure cabin fever.
Oh, God. And what makes it worse, it's been the hottest it's been
right.
All year.
Right.
And, yeah, it's just, oh, it's lovely. It's lovely.
I cannot imagine.
Yeah, exactly. And you?
I mean, having to be out in the world, I'm surprised that I have survived because it not only is it hot, but people are really forgetting we're still in the middle of a pandemic.
Oh.
So everybody just really, you know, lives like, oh, it's summer.
Yeah, no. It's summer. It's, hey, we're in stage four.
Right.
And so I'm going to lose my mind.
It's scary. It's literally scary.
Oh, yeah, man. I mean, just, yeah, it's really unfortunate. But, you know.
Like, I'm still avoiding crowds, though.
I've been inside for 9 days, so I'm safe.
Is that the longest have you been inside it since this whole quarantine started?
Literally.
Oh, man.
I literally have not walked out of my building.
Oh, God.
For 9 days.
How long?
And let me kind of put that in reference. That
okay.
It's kind of like being sequestered on a jury, but you can't stand anybody that you're with. So you basically are by yourself through that whole time.
Right.
But at least they have meals brought to them. I, on the other hand, do not have that luxury.
Yeah, depend for yourself.
Oh, God. It's amazing what you can do with one hand and a crutch.
Oh, God. How long did it take you to even accept, like, oh, this is my reality now for the next couple of days? Like, this is it. This is all I got right now. How long did it take you to accept that?
Once I got out of the haze of having surgery,
mm-hmm.
I think it was like 4 days, I was like, oh, crap, man. And it wasn't for lack of trying.
Right.
That's the other thing. It wasn't for lack of trying. I actually tried to go outside.
Oh, okay.
And I made it as far as the elevator from my door, which I believe is less than 40 feet.
Oh, wow.
And the room started spinning.
Oh, no.
You know, it started kvetching. Right. Yeah. Yeah, no, it was ugly.
That was it.
Yeah, pretty much.
But how occupying your time with, you know, just being at home all day?
I've gotten a new appreciation for enlightenment.
Have a lot of realizations.
You know, it's like, you know, they say that Buddha went into a cave for 20 years and came out enlightened. And I'm like, that is such horse shit. I can tell you right now. There is no way.
Yeah, 20 years alone does not sound.
Oh, God.
I can't even imagine 9, so 20. Sheesh.
I can't imagine those guys that go in, like, in prison
Right.
And they go into solitary confinement.
Right.
You will lose your mind. Right. I'm going stir crazy, but I got stuff. You know.
Right.
They have nothing.
Right.
Except their wits.
Right. Did you see the Danny Trejo documentary I told you about? Inmate number one.
Inmate number one. Well, let me tell you something.
Yeah, it's funny that you brought up the solitary, because there was a moment in the documentary where he was like, they put him in solitary and he was just reciting lines from Wizard of Oz. Like, yes, I'm going to get you and your dog too.
Yeah. After he said, I was in my cell in lockdown, and and I saw this writing on the wall. It said, God doesn't exist. Oh, but God. did you catch the part where he said it was written in feces?
Right.
I'm like, wait a minute. I gotta be in lockdown in an 8 by or a 6 by or whatever size that cell is. And they don't clean off the feces from the wall.
Right. And you just start smelling that for the next couple of days. I would want to trade places with him. Was that your machete voice, though? Was that your machete voice? I feel like everybody who watched Machete had a machete voice.
Machete, don't text. That was good. That was a good part. That was a good part when Robert Rodriguez said that.
When he ain't got the line for it?
Yeah, Danny kept calling him. He goes, right. He kept telling him, just text me. But Machete, don't text. he goes, oh, that's going in the movie.
I mean, any genius director would have to do it. There's no way you hear a line like that and you don't throw it in a movie. That has to go in the movie.
Yeah, it was great.
Yeah, and that documentary, Inmate Number One, it showed up randomly on my Facebook feed, and I wasn't planning on buying it at first, but once I thought about it, and I was like, you know what? I want to know more about Danny Trejo, because...
When do you ever see a documentary that has 100% and Rotten Tomato score?
Right.
I was like, that's bullshit. They never give 100%. Right. Anything.
Literally.
And I was like, oh, that's got to be bullshit. And, that's got to be some liberal progressive bullshit. Right. Well, he's Mexican, and he's been around for a long time, so we're just going to give him. No, but he is one of the scariest motherfuckers I've ever met.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, you met him?
Yeah, a long time ago.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it was anything huge. We didn't sit there and have a conversation.
Right.
But he's not a big guy.
Right, I can imagine.
Let me tell you. he has that full, he can go full convict very quickly. Very quickly. He's had an amazing life.
Right.
Amazing life. From really unbelievable hardship from his own doing.
Right.
But what I didn't realize is that he was a drug counselor for so many years.
Right.
I mean, it wasn't like five, it was like 20.
Mm-hmm. Decade. Right.
And they were, sending them around the country to guest speak and stuff. I didn't know that part.
Right. When I first saw the beginning of it, and they're talking about when he was a child and, he was doing heroin at age 12, I immediately sent the document to my brother. I'm like, bro, you think you got it hard? This guy was on some hard drugs.
And that was he was doing that in the 50s.
Right.
That was one of the things that it surprised me is like how old he is.
Right.
He's got to be like 75.
Right. That's a grown man.
But he doesn't act or look 75.
No, he doesn't. Not at all.
You know, I mean,
now the movie Badass make more sense because they had him looking really gray and old in that movie. And now I'm like, okay, right. It makes sense now. I get it. I get why he looked that old in that. But he definitely don't look like that in real life. He don't look that old at all.
You know, I haven't seen any of those Machete movies.
Really?
No.
No.
I was like, really? I looked at that shit and I was like, that was like a bad version of Shaft, you know?
I mean, that was the point of it. Yeah, you know? It was supposed to be.
No, local. I know. So. But I didn't realize, like how popular they had become.
Right.
And that, you know, they decided that it was going to be like the black exploitation movies.
Right.
In the in the 60s and 70s, but it was going to be Mexican, and they just went. And they said they were just going right over the top with the box, like right over the top. And then they were showing clips of that. I was like, in the first opening scene, they said, well, in the opening scene, he goes, oh, Jesus.
I'll tell you, when that movie came out, I was so excited. I was so excited. I must have been at least maybe in my early 20s, maybe 21. And I just couldn't wait for that film. I just couldn't wait because I grew up on Robert Rodriguez films. He was probably one of the first filmmakers that made me believe that I can make films because all his DVDs would have like these film school lessons on there. So like, hey guys, all you need is a camera, some sound effects, and you can make a movie too. So growing up, I was just in love with films.
What's up? Dude. You're such a nerd. God,
I am.
You're having an outward bromance with Robert Rodriguez.
I spoke to him once. I spoke to him on Twitter, and I was like, "Hey, man, I gotta tell you, like, he taught me everything I know, and now I'm teaching other kids what you taught me." And he was just like, "Oh man, that's great. I love hearing stuff like this." But then he wouldn't respond to no more messages after that. So I was like,
Can you imagine how many he does?
Right. I'm pretty sure
he gets like all the time. He's too busy. He's too busy answering the phone from Danny.
right. Have you seen Desperado? That was one of the first.
Yes.
That was my first introduction to the adult films of Robert Rodriguez, but also my first film with Danny Trejo. Because before that, I didn't see Con Air. I didn't see Blood In and Blood Out. You know, I don't think I saw Heat at that point either. Because I think I saw Heat when I was like 16. So yeah.
Heat was probably one of my top three movies,
right?
That I liked. I mean, it was just amazing,
right?
I mean, the way they played that whole line, everybody in that, it was just like, damn, yeah, that was a really good movie. I've seen that. God, I've probably seen that 10 times, and I don't do that.
You know, only 10?
Yeah, exactly. I direct you to my former statement about you. Only 10? Jeez, I must have watched that thing at least 35 times.
Oh, yeah. When I was in my Michael Mann stage, I definitely must have seen that movie over 1,500 times, maybe. That, Collateral, when he did Miami Vice, like those films I would just watch it back to back almost weekly basis. Especially when I had my huge Al Pacino phase. When I was younger, I had a very, like, especially when I was 16, I had, like, I just want to see Pacino all day. So it was like, if Pacino was in it, I'm watching it. You know? And it was just, and it was
Fredo, you broke my heart.
I was actually rewatching Carlito's Way the other day, and the movie started. It was like, yeah, man, who would have thought a badass Puerto Rican like me? I'm like, oh, man, this movie would never be able to work today. Not at all.
No.
Al Pacino calling himself a Puerto Rican, that's not going to work today. That's
No. Nope. It didn't really work then. It was just like, you're sitting there and you're going, what? but it was Al Pacino. You
could
basically do anything.
Right.
It's like it's like Tom Cruise playing Jack Reacher.
Right. Oh, well, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know about that one.
Yeah,
it's like, you know, I don't know. Tino talk is like poetry sometimes. You know what I mean? Just like,
the way
he delivered those lines. Like, I know you're not Puerto Rican, but I'm here with you, brother. I'm here with you. I can hear it. Like, I remember I was so confused when I was younger because, you know, I had Scarface, The Godfather trilogy, and The Carlito's Way. I watched them all at the exact same time, and I was just like, wait, what is he? Is he Italian? Then he's Cuban in this one. And, you know, I was like, how is this even possible? How can you do this? You know, like, ah. But Pacino, one of the greatest, one of the greatest. I watch Pacino in anything, even The Irishman, even though
that. Did you see him? Did you see Dog Day Afternoon?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. That was one of the main things I watched when I was on my Pacino phase. I was like, oh, I got because everybody was talking about it for, especially when you talk about heist films. You know, they were like, oh, you have to see Dog Day Afternoon. You have to. It's the godfather of all of them.
Dude, I saw that in the theater.
How was that in theaters at that time?
It was amazing. I mean, it was just like, because he's, I don't know the actor's name, but the guy who played Fredo
in
The Godfather played his partner.
Right.
In that. But that was crazy, man.
That movie, that's really progressive now if you really think about it. Because wasn't he trying to like raise the money so the guy way
partner can get a sex change? Yeah.
Right. That movie was really.
Oh yeah, man. Very.
That kind of aged really well, I think. Out of all Pacino movies, that
one kind of. They were. Did they film that in New York City?
I can't remember.
Yeah, I can't remember if they did.
Maybe before my time. I definitely don't.
But it was just like you know, films back then were like greasy. Yeah.
Right. They're gritty. I mean,
very, very gritty.
Right. Now it's way too polished. They don't have that grit anymore. Like manufactured grit. Like you see more
Tarantino. Tarantino can pull it off.
Yeah, Tarantino could pull it off, but you know, I feel like TV has got a lot grittier than film lately.
Well, of course, because that's where the majority of the talent went.
Right.
After the writer's strike in the 80s, everything changed. You know, film actors wouldn't be caught dead on TV.
Right.
But after the writer's strike in the 80s, man, that all of a sudden those big actors couldn't get work.
Right.
So they were like, oh, shit.
Like, oh, they paying over here?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I can keep my light bill on if I go over to ABC.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know. It's you get like the Eastwood films and the spaghetti westerns and you know those are like really gritty things, but. You know, this is a different time too. You know, the grittiness back then. You know, the way society was, it was just a reflection of society.
Right.
Society was a lot grittier back then.
Right. Yeah. Cause I remember when I saw Bad Lieutenant, I was like, boy, was it this bad?
Yep.
I was like, no way. This could be life. That was New York for you.
Have you seen that special on Netflix yet about the mob in New York?
No, what's that one called?
Yeah, it's I can't remember the name of it right now. It just came out.
Right. Okay.
But it's basically a documentary of the mob and how they control New York City.
Right.
Which then, you know, spread out to other areas of the country. But Giuliani's on there and some of the other guys, and that was his rise to power.
Right.
Was, you know, he went in and
fighting the mob.
Yeah. And just, you know, he went in with Chertoff. He was, I think under Obama, he was a director of the Department of Homeland Security, I think. Right. I can't remember his first name. But there were two other guys. So there was this group of four, Giuliani and these three young attorneys that basically took on the mob and used, that was the first time that they had used the RICO statutes on organized crime. It was really fascinating when they start talking about how they went about dismantling it. They stopped going after individuals.
Right.
And then, you know, in this documentary, they show you that, you know, here is the five families of New York, and here's the structure. There's the boss, there's the underboss, right, there's the captains, and then there are the soldiers.
Right.
But then they find out through surveillance that there's this thing called the commission.
Mm.
And it turns out that the commission is all of the five family bosses who basically make decisions for the entire organization.
Right.
And when that came up, then Giuliani came in and said, that's what we're going after.
Right. They went after
we're gonna go after the commission so that anybody that is involved below them is going to get put in with the RICO statutes.
Right.
And that's how they ended up taking the mob out of New York.
Right.
Fascinating story.
It is.
And then Giuliani became mayor.
Right.
And back in the heyday when stuff started getting cleaned up.
And that's when they say that's when Times Square became like Disneyland.
Yes, exactly.
And a lot of the stories that I've heard about Rudy is mostly a lot from, you know, mafia-related documentaries. Like, recently I was watching one on Gotti, on John Gotti. It was his, I think the documentary was mostly about his son. And, yep, you know, basically, you know, he was telling the story about, you know, his life with his father becoming, being the mafia boss and what happened after his father went to jail and how, yep, you know, everything basically fell on top of him because he was the son of Gotti. And, you know, they were showing clips from the John Travolta Gotti movie, which I always thought was not a really good movie at all. You know, I went just because of Travolta. If Travolta's on a poster, I'll probably go see it. But,
Well, number one, he's Italian. Number two, mm-hmm, he's John Travolta.
Right.
That was.
I can watch that man in anything. I really can.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting because you've got in Giuliani taking over the Southern District Federal Court or Federal Southern District Attorney.
Mm-hmm.
He half his team was Italian,
right?
Which I didn't realize, and I was like, that's interesting. How's that?
Giuliani, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So the Italians taking down Italians.
Yeah, and it's interesting getting perspective.
Mm.
But they always said that his team was always saying that he was a media hound. Yeah, so anytime that he could get in front of the camera, they all knew that he'd be in front of the camera. But, you know, look, he was just laying the ground to become mayor.
Right.
That's what he was doing.
Basically.
And that's what he ended up doing. He did an amazing job.
And it worked for him. Yeah.
Well, he was the right guy at the right time.
Right. Especially for the way New York was at that moment.
Yes. You know, the city needed cleaned up, and he came in and did that.
Right.
Doesn't matter if you agree with how he did that, and how many people were oppressed during that time, but you take how the city was back then and how it is like today.
Mm-hmm.
I would much rather have it like it was.
Right. You'd rather have it where it is today or have it was back before?
No, when he cleaned up the city,
right,
is how I would like it, because it is not like that today.
What's the difference?
Well, I want to be able to pick up a phone,
uh-huh,
and say, I got some dude pissing on my building and having the police come out and do something.
Right. Okay. I get it. Right.
But under our current administration,
mm-hmm,
De Blasio, basically has neutered the police.
Mm-hmm.
So quality of life laws are not enforced.
Right.
So now we have not gotten as bad as, let's say, San Francisco. or...
Yeah, I've heard San Francisco got, like, a really bad homeless problem out there.
Dude.
Like, they literally have to get rough.
Dude, let me tell you something. I lived in San Francisco in the 90s.
Right.
Okay? They had a bad problem then, mm-hmm. and it doesn't even hold a candle to what's going on out there now.
Yikes.
I mean, it is unbelievable mm-hmm. what they're getting away with out there.
Right.
And, you know, and I'm only going to get political for a second, but if you look at all of those cities uh-huh. that this is an issue,
mm-hmm.
they're all progressive democratic cities. Every one of them.
So what, all those skid rows are like basically just Chaz under a different name?
Yeah, exactly. they've been Chaz for decades.
Right. They have a term for it.
Yeah, I mean California is sliding right off the map.
Right.
Because of all the literal shit that they have going through their streets. Mm. Seattle, Portland, they're all the same.
Right.
And it's very unfortunate because California is a beautiful state, man. Beautiful state.
I didn't know how bad their homeless situation was until I saw it was two films. I think it was one called Where the Day Takes You, and yep. another one called The Soloist with Robbie Downey Jr. and Jamie Foxx. Yep. Yep. And I was watching the behind the scenes of the film, and they actually went to where the homeless are, where all the skid rows. And I was like, wait, this is real? That's real people? And I couldn't believe it.
Like, well, the thing like Skid Row has been around for a long time.
Right.
And it has been, an area where like the drunks would go.
Mm-hmm.
Back in the day, that's what you would call them. They were
because
a lot of them were just,
alcohol, heavy drinkers, right?
But
now you got a whole bunch of drugs.
Mm-hmm. Over time, it's now those two blocks, let's say, of Skid Row.
Mm-hmm.
Have now gone all the way to the courthouse, which is on that same road.
Wow. Insane.
They had, look at this. Last summer,
mm-hmm.
they had 8 reported cases of typhus.
Typhus?
Do you know what typhus is?
No, I don't think I heard that one before.
It's because it was eradicated in like the 20s.
Oh, wow. It brought something back in the 20s?
It was a medieval disease that was passed by rodents.
Wow.
And it had taken out about a third of the population of the world.
Right. Wow.
And because of the living situations in these homeless campsites mm-hmm. that are all over the city, they had all these reported cases of typhus.
Wow.
Typhus. I'm like, what?
All the things to bring back.
No, exactly. No, exactly.
That's the wrong nostalgia, people. That's the wrong nostalgia to bring.
I mean, I don't know about you, but if you go to the... oh God! What is the book in the Bible where Armageddon happens?
Remember when they had the leprosy?
It's like the 7 seals.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
I can't remember what part of the Bible that is because I'm not a good Christian, or I'm just old. but basically, they're over this past year. Mm-hmm. It's like okay, we have 5 of the 7 seals that have been broken.
Right. You got the locust.
the famine. Yeah, yeah.
Plague.
Famine, pestilence. I mean, all that shit's happening, man.
Right.
I mean, literally happening. I mean, all the pestilence with the locusts in where was that? In Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just end of days, man. End of days.
This is it. It's funny because one of my favorite movies is Arnold Schwarzenegger in End of Days, and since all this been happening, I haven't had the heart to rewatch that movie. I was like, you know what, life is getting too close to.
It's like when this shutdown all started happening with the pandemic, and people were watching Contagion.
I was one of the.
Why would you do that? Why would you do that? It's like, yeah. No. This is probably the worst thing that you've ever seen in your lifetime. But you know what? I'm just going to double down, and I'm going to terrify myself by watching this movie.
And you know what's funny? Contagion wasn't the one that really affected me too bad. It was Outbreak that made me like, oh, I should be like, Outbreak is the reason why I'm not going to the movies when they reopen. Like, that one sequence when in the movie theater,
it's like, oh, man,
it's like, laughing, and then
what's on the seat?
I'm so terrified of going to the theater just because of that one sequence in Outbreak. I'm like, nope, I'm not doing it. Actually, this weekend will be my first time actually going to, well, not an actual movie theater, but I'm going to a drive-in this weekend to see Harlem Nights with Eddie Murphy and Richard Pryor. That's going to be maybe the first movie I've seen any crowd since. You know, and it's crazy thing about it, like, that's how I know I really miss the movies, because that movie is not on my top list of top Eddie Murphy movies. It's not on my top list for, like, top black films, top comedies. It's nowhere on any of my top films list. But because it's a, you know, outdoor film, and I could be in my car, I was like, you know what?
It's because you're jonesing. Jonesing for a movie, man. I'm jonesing. I can't get my normal fix, so I gotta go the other way. I gotta go to withdrawal. I gotta go to the methadone clinic. God, so I gotta go to the drive-in.
Right. And I was like, you know what? It's around the corner. It's not too far from my home. You know, I do love Eddie Murphy. Fine, let's go. I'm gonna go do it. Let me go see it. You know, but it's literally not my Eddie Murphy films. That's probably nowhere near on top of my top Eddie Murphy films. You know, even gangster films. Like, you know me. I was listening to Scarface and The Godfather through the womb. And but this Harlem Nights did not take. It's not. It doesn't cut it.
Oh my God, you need to kill me.
I'm telling you, my mom will come one day on the show and she'll tell the story. I'm telling it.
That would be awesome. That would be awesome. We're going to bond. No question.
Did I ever tell you the story when I found out that she had me hearing this stuff through the womb? So around that time, like I tell you, when I was 16, when I had the Al Pacino phase, you know, this is when I was really in theater. I'm like, I want to be an actor. And I'm like, all the way in. And this guy was selling a whole bunch of DVDs, you know.
That Dude, hold on. Did you just use the word thespian?
Yeah, I think that's a phrase it is. That's not a thespian actor. That's not a thing.
Yeah. Nerd. You're such a nerd.
Like, I just proved I was doing the drama stuff for that one. Like, oh, yeah.
Thespian. I'm going to be a thespian. I'm like, oh, my God.
Hey, man, I love my craft. What can I say?
There you go, man. Better to love that than crack.
Right.
I mean, things could be a lot worse. No problem. Right?
Like, that's why I sent my brother that Inmate Number One documentary. I was like, hey, man, this guy was on, like, my hard drug at 12, bro. Like, what are you going through? This man was like,
you ain't got shit over this guy, man.
Not over Danny. Anytime anybody's gonna tell me some shit about their life, I'm gonna point out Danny. Like, I don't know, man. I've heard about, you know,
exactly
some things, but Danny seen some things.
when they're talking about all those like alpha guys from Hollywood, and they're doing I don't know what was it, Con Air or something. Everybody's like talking about how bad they were in certain times of their lives. And
Cage. Cage, who said.
Yeah, Cage walks up and looks at Danny, looks at these guys and goes, well, I don't know about you guys, but that's the guy I'd be more afraid of.
I mean, if you look at that cast, who else would you be more afraid of? It was definitely Danny. Danny had that look. It was just like, oh, man, that's like, not the guy you want to mess with.
But what a humble dude, man.
Very
just humble dude, you know. And when he talks about Charles Bronson,
right?
Oh, it was like awesome. Or De Niro,
Right.
See, this is what I didn't know about the Machete movies, man.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that De Niro in it?
Was like De Niro and Mel Gibson and, you know, these big-time actors were in them. I had no idea.
It's
no
a great idea. Film. Well, the first Machete, I would say, is a great film. That second one, I was very disappointed in. I was like, okay, now you're going the Spy Kids route with this one. But that first one, it was on, like, if you love exploitation films, you know, the old grindhouse films.
Yep.
Machete was everything. It felt like it belonged in that era of films. But the second one, I'm not a fan of. But what I was saying, well, Pacino. So one day, no, it was a week actually. Now that I remember, it was a week. So every day I would come home from school and I would watch a different Pacino movie. So, you know, one day it'll be Carlito's Way, then it'll be The Godfather, Godfather Part 2, Godfather Part 3, and Scarface. And my mom came home one day. Usually she, at the time, she didn't come home at this time, but some reason that day she came home early. They were like, I think she was sick or something. And she just froze at the door because she's hearing, you know, all the, you know, the amount of fucks that was coming out of Al Pacino's mouth in the movie. So she just freezes like, wait, I know that voice. I know that. Like, and she's like, and then she comes in and she just freezes at the door. And she just sees me watch the movie, and I'm just like, "Oh, hey, Ma!" And you hear all the fuck, all this, and she's just sitting there and she's just staring at me. So I'm thinking I'm in trouble because of, you know, how much cursing is going on in the movie. Cause I'm like 16, and so I'm like, "Oh, I'm sorry, Mom. You know, is this movie offending you? Should I, you know, stop it, pause it, whatever?" And she was like, "I used to watch this movie when I was pregnant with you." Like, all the time. I was like, "What?" Like, I used to watch this all the time when I was pregnant with you. And then, like, the next couple of weeks, I kept rewatching Scarface because I was just in love with Brian De Palma's directing with Scarface and Carlito's Way. And she thought it was something that she did. She's like, "Oh my God, I ruined you. I ruined you. You can't stop watching this movie now. Like, this is, oh, it's all my fault." I'm like, "No, Mom, no, don't worry. I'm not going to become a drug dealer. Don't worry. I'm not selling drugs tomorrow." Like, that's not what I'm getting from this movie, Mom. Relax. That's not what I'm getting from this.
Yeah. I might be an actor portraying a drug dealer.
Oh, yeah. My first movie, like, because of films like Godfather and Scarface, I was so set on, like, my first movie's got to be a gangster movie. It happened.
Oh, God.
Because Robert Rodriguez taught me that you got to use what you got. So I'm like, all right, I live in the hood. I got some prop guns. There's definitely some gangbangers outside. Screw it. We're making a gangster movie. Let's do it. You know? And I didn't even realize how crazy it was until one of my actors who had no gang affiliation, haven't really been in the hood. You know, one day she just came to me and she's like, "Hey, are those guys really, like, gang members?" And I'm like, "Oh, shoot, yeah. I'm sorry. I should have gave you the heads up. Yeah.
Given me the heads up."
Like, "Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. They're not actors. They're not."
No. That's them.
But it worked out at the end. It really worked out at the end because nobody could tell who was the actors and who wasn't when they watched the film. They're like, "Wow, you had a really great cast." And I'm like, "You know, only half of the people are acting."
Yeah, exactly.
My mom still had horror stories when she thinks about it, because we have bank robberies and everything. She's like, "There's no way I would be able to make that film now in the current climate of how New York is."
No, you just get shot.
Right, basically, yeah. On the spot. Yeah.
No, and exactly.
That's the great thing about it.
It's like, stop and frisk? No. It's going to be shoot. And then, what are you doing?
Right. And it's crazy, because I didn't even think about it until recently, because the first day, I want to say it was the first day of filming, and I wanted to get the bank robbery out the way. And we have a ATM area not too far from here. And I knew, you know, because it's in my small neighborhood, I'm like, okay, you know, the mall usually closes around this time. The ATM will still be open. We could go in around this time and shoot this quick bank robbery. You know, I have 3-4 actors in there. My lead actor is supposed to come in with the gun, do the robbery, and get out. We should get it done in one take. When he got to the bank and realized that we were not only in the actual bank, but we had no permits or anything, he was like, "I'm not doing this movie, bro. I can't. And because it was the first day, I'm just like, "What?"
I'm a young man, man. I can't go to prison.
Right.
Because that's federal time.
And all I said was, "Here, hold the camera. I'll do it then." And I just always think about the people who came, like, who would want to go to the ATM, and they saw us making a movie, and they're like, "It's okay, we'll wait.
Exactly. Yeah, we'll wait. We'll wait while they're calling." "Hi, police. This is, I'm at the corner of..."
Right, there's a whole robbery going on here. I can't tell what's going on. You know, and I'm lucky enough, I was smart enough when I walked into the bank, I had a huge sign to point to the camera, like, "Hey guys, we're just making a movie." So I've never got any calls about that. Even funny enough, I even have a scene in the precinct when I escaped the precinct. And something told me I wasn't going to get the permission to shoot the scene. So I was like, guys, before we go in and ask, just get a shot of me running out the precinct real quick. And they're like, what? I'm like, don't worry about it. I know what I'm doing. I got this. And walk right in, run right back out. And there's everybody just terrified, like, oh, shoot. I'm about to die. You're about to get arrested. I'm like, no. We got it. We got the tape. You got it on this camera. You got it on that camera. All right, cool. Shoots over. Then I went inside and went to act like, hey, officer, you know, I'm a filmmaker. I want to keep the scene. They're like, yeah, we'll call you. They never called me. They never
reached out. Of course not.
But I got
there. Like, it's like, get out of here, kid.
It really was. It really was.
We'll call you.
But the thing was, you know, especially at that age, I was just like, so like those gangster movies were just so like, the way I looked at them, I didn't see them as gangsters. They were more like badass entrepreneurs. You know what I mean? It wasn't until I was older and started realizing what's wrong with those images of a gangster.
Entrepreneurs.
Yeah, they were badass entrepreneurs. That's how I looked at it.
Wow.
It was years before, dude. I truly understood what was wrong with the image. Because, like, I think it was when I was watching.
It's probably because half of your neighborhood was.
Right. Everybody was like, about that life. Right.
Yeah, just like that. It was like.
You know, like, that was the culture, quote unquote. You know, and it wasn't until, like, the older I got, I'm just like, there's something completely wrong with this being our culture. Like, why are we teaching each other, you know, we got to rob, we got to steal, you know, we got to pimp. You know, once I got that the gangster movie out of my system and made the movie, and when I was able to realize what was wrong with the image, especially because, you know, I was portraying my own neighborhood as, you know, like this crime-filled neighborhood, and in reality, my neighborhood wasn't really that bad. You know, there's mostly elderly people here who are retired. You know, people who are raising their families. You know, like there's a small bunch, of course, the bad apples everywhere.
Were they retired gang members?
No, my neighborhood actually was a very peaceful neighborhood. I think until maybe the late 80s is when stuff started getting, you know, ghettofied or whatever. But from there, I think, I call it ghettofied. Yes, when they got ghettofied.
See, I learned something new every day, man.
That's not an actual term, though. So.
Ghettofied, and what was that? The conscious community?
You got the whole type of community. Yeah.
Oh, I've actually used that on a few people I know. And they were like, oh, yeah, that's the thing. I was like, oh, damn, man, he was right.
Slowly, you learn the culture. You're slowly getting it. Slowly getting it. Piece by piece, every episode. Getting it.
Well, it's what happens when you check your white privilege.
But, you know, it's the truth, though. Our culture, especially when it comes to, like, the hip-hop culture, is all, you know, this, you know, everybody's a tough guy. Everybody's a gangster. You know, you got to be a drug dealer. You got to be a gangster. Even when we were talking about Grand Theft Auto last week, I was thinking about that, too. I was just like, you know, the amount of damage this Grand Theft Auto did alone. Like, I was talking to a few, in one of the earliest installments of Grand Theft Auto, they have one called San Andreas, which takes place in California. And that one, it's all about gang culture. Literally all about gang culture. And. Yep. I asked one of my friends, I was like, hey, how much do you think that game affected you? And he was like, I don't think it affected me too much. I was like, all right, so when you play Grand Theft Auto today, if you see somebody wearing purple, what do you do? He's like, oh, I'm going to shoot that man. I'm like, well, why? And I was like, that's what they taught you to do in the early game. Like, you see someone wearing those colors, you went after them, you know? And he didn't even think about it. He was like, wow, I didn't even realize that still affected me that way. You know, and I was like, that's everything that we have, you know, where you look at our movies, you know, especially if you look at, like, Superfly or, you know, Black Caesar, you know, like, these were...
I love those movies.
I was with my older brother the other day, and, you know, I always love to watch old films with him, and those are the films he always bring up. Like, oh, man, we got to watch, you know, the Fred Williamson films, the Jim Brown films. I'm like, bro, other than, you know, Shaft, these guys were all playing drug dealers and gangsters. Like, I thought there was more positive image back then. I was like, oh, no, this is where it started. I get it now. Yeah. This is
well,
where it
started. I was all about the sisters, man.
The Foxy Brown, the Foxy Coffee.
Foxy Brown. Yep. Yep.
Yeah, and I think, well, the thing about Coffee, Coffee was a nurse. Coffee wasn't a drug dealer. That's why she was killing the drug dealers. So it was different.
Yeah,
different.
Yeah, no, it was awesome. That stuff was
just, I would actually love a good Coffee remake right now. I think I would I would enjoy that. That would be good.
But who would play?
Oh, no, you can't replace Pam Grier. It's Pam is just one of a kind. It's just one of a kind.
Halle Berry is Coffee. No, I don't think that would work.
It would just be Coffee liked.
Yeah. No, exactly. Yeah, that's not Coffee. That's an Americano.
Right. It's a little Coffee with cream, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
But you know,
whoa, I'm not going there, man.
Yeah, I'm allowed to say that one.
I mean if you and I had a kid, maybe, you know.
Well, you know, what I was thinking about is, like, you know, especially after I did my first gangster movie, I started realizing the image, because, you know, I filmed in my neighborhood and, you know, sharing it, and I'm just like, wow, look at the image that I'm portrayed of my neighborhood when it wasn't even, you know, that dangerous like that. You know what I mean?
Well, this country has idolized the gangster
persona
since like the 1800s.
Really, that far back?
Think about Billy the Kid.
Oh, right.
I mean, Billy the Kid, man. They wrote.
There's no writing about Billy.
Books about him.
Right.
You know, like they were almost like comic books.
Right.
About him. I don't know what the genre of the writing was, but, you know, writers made these guys into folk heroes.
Right.
And then over the years, they get into like the 20s during Prohibition. And everything that was happening, you got Kelly, Dillinger, and what's his name, Capone, and all these guys, and they, you know, there was a persona,
right? Bonnie and Clyde,
in the community of the mafia, the Italian mafia, in the communities, they were reveled in, you know, they were anti-conformists, and there is a, you know, our country has a fascination with that because we're such a conformity type of nation. You know, we're a nation of laws and rules, and, you know, pretty much the general public follows those.
Right.
But it's those outliers, those people that are, you know, go against the grain. They forget, you know, this. And I've talked to quite a few FBI agents and who were on the organized crime task force, and they talk about how romanticized these guys were in, you know, the mafia guys. How romanticized they were in people's minds.
Right.
But what the part that people didn't see was they would turn on their people in a heartbeat.
Right.
In a heartbeat.
Mm-hmm.
Not all of them.
Mm-hmm.
But the bulk of them, right. You know, if they were given a choice.
Right.
We're going to give you 2 years in prison if you give us the name of this guy, or, you know, who did this job.
Right.
You know, all these guys were telling me is like, yeah, as soon as they get jammed up, everybody, because it's not just them. It's everybody.
Right.
You know, there's very few guys that when they start to get jammed up, they're not going to flip.
Right.
You know, very, very few.
Right. The more reason why I stayed out of that life, because I'm like, if I got to look over my shoulder or got to worry about I got to testify one day, then there's no reason for me to get in now. I'll stay away. Like, I'm okay. I'll fake it.
I think it's funny that you actually had that choice to make. You know, when you think about it, because I mean, for me, I never, that wasn't even
an opportunity
in the universe. That wasn't even the universe of my world.
Right.
But with you,
that was actually that's a choice.
Exactly. It was like that was an option.
You get the opportunity to join.
You know, I would like option number three, please. Gangster life.
I think what solidified that I was never going to join anything is the fact that Al Pacino died in every one of those gangster movies that I saw. I was like, you know, he never survived not one of those movies. I was like, not Scarface, you know, not Carlito's Way. You know, even though Godfather, he got to an old man, his daughter died before he could even get there. So maybe he just, all the way around, it doesn't look like a good idea.
I think
healthier life, you know, staying out of prison.
I was such a Boy Scout for so long. I mean, literally just a straight up Boy Scout, you know, and I could not fathom doing something wrong.
Right.
You know, It's like, and to my, you know, to my detriment, because I would hang out with some of my teammates as a young kid, and you know, there's some shit that would happen, and I'm like, I'm not doing that. You know, I'm like, I ain't doing that. And right. then they do something and go, I didn't do that. And everybody's like, well, we're part of the team. Everybody's got to do the same. And I'm looking at them like, what? Fuck you. I didn't do that. But, you know, I didn't have the concept of team at that point.
Right.
Kind of like the military.
Right.
You never volunteer in the military for a reason. But, you know, one guy fucks up, everybody fucks up, that kind of thing.
Right.
Oh, God, I don't know. But, yeah, we have this, you know, we have this romantic affiliation with the gangster.
Right.
Those nonconformists.
Play by their own rules.
Yeah, but, I mean, look, like, even with some of the Eastwood movies.
Mm-hmm.
Even though some of those spaghetti westerns, he wasn't the good guy.
Right.
You know,
the he was like hero.
Thank you. It was like, you know, the Antichrist. That was kind of what he was playing. What was the one where he's like a mirage? What?
One of the westerns?
Yeah.
What, the good, bad, and ugly?
No.
That one.
It was the one that.
The Man with No Name?
I think it was that one, The Man with No Name.
Right.
You know, it's like he's... Is that the one where they painted the town all red and stuff?
Dang. I gotta rewatch it.
I mean, it was just like you know, it's like you go through the whole film,
uh-huh.
and then all of a sudden, I think it was towards the end of the film, he just disappeared. Yeah, exactly. He just, like, evaporated. I'm like, what? What? What the hell was that? You know, it wasn't like Shane or something like that. It was
right.
That was crazy.
But the gangster image has been around for a very long time, and people still to this day, you know, love it. You know, like all the way down to if you want to take just even music in general. You know, that's where where I see that someone could come in and be like, yeah, I sold drugs, I've been in jail, and you know, they applaud him for that. Like, yeah, you're the coolest. You know, and it's like,
yeah, wait, exactly.
Like, hold on now.
Well, it's like how many? I always find it interesting when you find someone in that genre of music who had a extremely white bread upbringing.
Oh yeah, there's plenty of them.
And then like Drake, who gets involved with certain people or has certain things. People around him, where he takes credit for certain stuff just to get cred.
Right.
Just to get cred. And I'm like, oh, God. And it's like, maybe I introduce him to Danny Trejo.
All right, then maybe here we'll humble himself a little bit more. I'll tell you, anytime I speak to anybody now who is about that life, I'm just going to show them that documentary. Like, you know, like, I really love those type of stories, you know, with the Danny Trejo story, or even if we go far as back as Malcolm X, somebody who were, you know, the life that they were living was up to par, and they realized it and was able to come out better, you know, the true underdog story. You know, like, yeah. I appreciate those stories more compared to the stories where, like, oh, yeah, I went to prison, and now I'm a hardcore gangster, and I'm coming out with this gangster mentality. You know, like, right. You know, like, that doesn't help anybody, you know? Like, that's all it does is just keeps the cycle continuing, you know?
Well, what I find, it's just little things that over time that you start paying attention to, like correctional facility.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that was just another PC way of trying to convey a message that had nothing to do with what was actually happening.
Right.
You know, correctional facility, what does that say to you? That says we're sending people there to be corrected in their behavior.
Right.
No. What you're doing is you're sending them to school.
Right.
And it's not the school that you want.
Right.
You know, because when people come out of there, if they go in not very educated, when they come out, they're, you know, they got a master's degrees in the darkness.
Right. They learn all the other stuff that they could be doing. I can do that too. I can do this.
Yeah. It was much better when you call them prisons,
mm-hmm.
and incarceration.
Right.
But it has nothing to do with rehabilitation.
Right.
Because they just don't do that.
I think they just don't like the term prison anymore.
Yeah, no, exactly.
I was watching, it was a documentary from the BBC. I can't remember the name of it, but it was recent. There's a group of, I think they were Muslims in China, right? A very small part of China. I forgot, it was like Wuhan, or not Wuhan, that's where the COVID came from.
Yeah, it's up in the northwestern part of the country.
Right, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Right, and you heard the stories about how they took a bunch of people and basically brought them to these, you know, basically their concentration camps. And they're like, oh, no, this is not prison. This is not concentration. No, this is a vocational.
Re-education.
Right,
this
re-education.
Is a re-education.
it's vocational, you know, education, you know.
And well, that's totalitarian governments have re-education. It's like Stalin had re-education camps.
They're not even prison.
But most people never came back from those.
I'm watching this documentary, and this woman, she was there for almost a year, and you know, then after they let her out, they forced her to work at one of these places where they make masks and gloves and everything, and then after 2 months, they let her out, and the way she described it, I'm like, this sounds like Nazi Germany. This doesn't sound like, you know, an educational place to go. Like, it's not the place where you're like, hey, I'm going to go learn how to, you know, get a job and everything. Like, that legit sounded like they were brainwashing a whole civilization. Like,
you must assimilate. It's like watching the Borg on Star Trek.
Right.
that is a classic example of a totalitarian regime.
Right.
We are the people, and you know, the resistance is futile.
Right.
Because that's what it is. When I saw that stuff,
mm-hmm.
on Star Trek, when I was like, oh my god, that's Russia, you know, or oh my god, that's China,
right.
or you know Iraq or wherever, you mm-hmm. know, at that time, because that's how they are.
Right.
You fall in line or you die.
Right.
Period.
So I think she does a great job of discussing, you know, political things and not forcing it down your throat. That's one thing I really do enjoy about sci-fi. Like, the other day I was rewatching RoboCop, and you know, you're watching in this movie, you know, you have corporate America aiding and you know, helping criminals, and they're inciting riots, and they're lowering property value, and you know, trying to buy up the city while, you know, privatizing the police force. And I'm like, wow, this is like 80s. This is like,
yeah.
you know, And I was like, how is this, it's so relevant to this day? This is the original RoboCop, people, not the remake, that polished one that's all, you know, all slick and stuff. I appreciate the old gritty one, but
Peter Weller.
Right.
The Peter Weller RoboCop, not the new and improved version.
That was horrible. I love the actor. Didn't like the film.
The actor's great.
Right. I watch him in anything, but not RoboCop. I wouldn't watch him in RoboCop.
But you saw him in The Killing, right?
Right, yeah. I haven't watched the complete The Killing yet, but I started
watching. Oh, my God, man. That was just, I was on the edge of my seat the entire series.
Right.
Because they were just so, you know, and I lived in that area.
Right. Oh, so you recognized
it. Filmed it. Yeah. Right. So I recognized, like, a lot of it. And, you know, the way that was always, it's very similar, like, with X-Files.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were filming in the Pacific Northwest,
right.
Usually in Vancouver, mm-hmm. Canada,
right?
And which is basically the same kind of environment.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that everything is wet, everything is overcast. You have these lush green foliage, and it was just dark.
Right.
And that's pretty much Seattle. I mean, 258 days a year of overcast.
Right.
In Seattle. So.
It just looked like what? An episode of Valhalla Murders, basically?
Yeah. Yeah. No, man. It was like, it was crazy. But I was watching that show and I was like, and the acting was so
superb.
Amazing. So amazing. And I had never seen him before. I can't remember his name. But he came, man, a drug addicted detective.
Right.
Oh, God. And he was like dead on. You totally believe that he was a drug addict.
Right. Like he played it to the T.
Yeah. Or like a recovering.
Yeah. Joe, that guy's name, Joel Kinnaman. That's his name, Joel Kinnaman.
Yes.
Yeah. RoboCop is it's not my favorite film from him, but I literally could watch him in anything. He just have that voice. Where it's like, yeah, that's a man.
Yeah.
Like, hey, he was in Suicide Squad, and I was just like, yup, I believe it. I believe he's a killer. That's him. Like, you just have one of those voices. Like, you know, I have one of those voices that get really high pitched sometimes, sound like Mickey Mouse. So when I hear like a real deep voice, I'm like, nah, that's a voice. That's a voice.
Mickey Mouse. Wow. Okay.
You know I'm really excited when you hear my voice go up there. When it gets to that Michael Jackson level, you know I'm really excited. Like, oh, he's happy. That kid is happy right now.
He's so happy. It sounds like a little girl.
There was one time I was doing an internship at the Courtyard Marriott, and the guy was like, hey, man, you put some bass in your voice, bro. Like, what's going on?
You got to be more black, son.
Come on. Put some bass in that voice. And I'm sitting here like, I'm just being me. I'm my truth, man.
I don't remember who it was, but there was a guy I was working with. This is a while ago, and he was black, and he was brought up in the suburbs in Connecticut.
Right.
And he was straight up, I think probably one of three black people in his high school, right?
Oh, boy.
So anyway, he comes to the city and he's working in the city, and he and I were talking one day, and again, this is not something I had any concept of.
Right.
And people were coming to me talking about him. I go, what are you talking about? Well, you know, he's just, he's really not black enough. I go, whoa, wait a minute. What the hell does that mean?
Right.
He's not black enough. What? He's too creamy? I'm literally trying to sit there and try to figure that out. It's like, what the hell does that mean?
What does that mean? Right.
Oh, and then, well, I got educated later. I'm like, okay.
That's levels to being black, Mark.
I'm
telling you, I'm fighting for my black card every day. Like, I'm a card carrying black guy. Come on, guys.
It's like Dante's 8 levels of hell.
The struggle is real, my friend.
Fighting for your black card. Oh, God.
It's real. You speak proper English way too much. You know, you don't know enough songs. You know, they start looking at you funny, like, wait, bruh. Where did you say you were raised from?
Yeah, exactly. Where you from?
Like, I had to start pulling out stuff from every corner. Like, okay, you proved it. You want to buy it. And instead, I have to go through these things. Like, bro, I really have to go through the worst of the worst just to prove my blackness to you. And apparently, that's the case. Yeah. Like, yeah, you know. Like, oh, you never struggled before. Oh, wait, you from Southside Jamaica, Queens? Okay, I'll give you that. Like,
I wonder what it would be like for me. It's like, I'm sorry, you're not white enough. What the fuck would that mean?
Way somebody would say that to you, if you really spoke in slang and, you know, like you were really part of the hip hop culture, then somebody may say that to you, like, wait a minute.
You mean like Drake?
The perfect example I can give you, matter of fact, you guys can see this right now on Fandango. There's a movie called Malibu Most Wanted, right?
Yes.
Have you seen it before?
Yes.
Yeah, so that's
hilarious. Hilarious.
That's where somebody would say, okay, you're not white enough when you're acting like Jamie.
Yeah, Kennedy. Wasn't that kid on SNL?
No. He had a show on, I think it was on WB. It was called the Jamie Kennedy Experiment. It was like part sketch, part, you know, candid camera. You know, he was in different characters.
That was hilarious, dude. I remember that.
Watched that movie weeks ago for the first time in like almost 10 years, and I was just, the jokes that I didn't understand as a child that I get now, I was like, wow, this movie was bold. This movie was really bold for some of these jokes. Yeah, I thought it was just hilarious. The whole thing, you know, you got, you know, the real street guys, then you got the black guys who are actors pretending to be street guys, and those are the ones that people will be like, hey, man, you're not black enough. Those are the Taye Diggs.
Taye Diggs.
Oh, and he was perfect in that film. Perfect.
Taye Diggs. That's great.
But
I don't know, bro.
To wrap it all up, you know, to bring it back to Danny's documentary, you know, the one thing that I really appreciate about that documentary, when he was like, you know, if you do good things will come back to you, you know, and that's right. the model that he went through for the rest of his life. You know, that's what made him, you know, start, you know, doing the motivational speeches, you know, which eventually led him to acting.
Do good things for others.
Right. That's the main thing.
Good things will come back to you.
Right. That was the main thing. You know, and look how well it worked out in his life. You know, he went from just being a drug counselor to, you know, just helping somebody on set do a movie to actually being part of the movie and then actually starting a whole, you know, film career. And then, you know, to fast forward, here we are in 2020, you know, he's in over, you know, more movies than John Wayne now, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
He got restaurants, you know, he got record labels, you know, and it just goes to show you. You know, hey, like, that's one of the reasons why I've been, like, sharing the documentary with people. I'm just like, you know, even though he plays a tough guy, you know, he's very humble and, you know, he's cares about bringing good into the world, you know, and I feel like we have more of that in the world. You know, we wouldn't have so much of, you know, the
problem. He decided to be the change.
Right. That's all it is. That's all we're asking people. Be the change if you want to see the world.
T-shirts to follow.
Until next time, guys.
All right, man. Take care.